Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And today we are privileged to have with us Francis Rocca. Many of you know him as a regular columnist for the Wall Street Journal, but currently he is now at the helm of the EWTN Vatican team. And he's written a terrific piece describing the first 3 months of Pope Leo's pontificate. And we are so happy to have him with us to discuss his insights. Frank, thanks so much for your time and for joining us today.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
So the title of your piece is called The Quiet American. What has struck you most about Pope Leo's first 100 days?
Well, what struck me, I remember when the afternoon when he was elected and when we had the white smoke after only four ballots. I was sitting actually in the workspace of a CBS TV where I was doing some commentary during the interregnum and during the conclave, and everybody was assuming that it was Cardinal Parolin, and that was the conventional wisdom that if it was a quick election, it would be Cardinal Parolin. Nothing whatsoever against Cardinal Parolin, but the prospect of an Italian Pope, a reserved diplomat, very discreet, was going to be, didn't seem very newsworthy. And so we were kind of in a very narrowly self-interested way, at least I was thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be, we're going from, you know, a journalistic bonanza under Pope Francis for 12 years to something much more quiet. And then when it was an American, the first American U.S.-born Pope in history, he just, you know, we were ecstatic and thinking, oh God, this is just going to be nonstop news. And it hasn't been that way. I mean, it was certainly news that he was the first American Pope, and people have taken a U.S.-born Pope, great interest in that. And also the complexity of his background. He's really a Peruvian bishop, he was before he became Pope. So there's that whole aspect. And so, and he's a very interesting figure in many ways, but he's been very low-key. He's been very low-key. He hasn't said a lot of things that have made news. He hasn't taken clear stands on controversial issues. His style is very reserved, even self-effacing. So I'm finding it surprising. Of course, the Catholic press, our outlet, you know, EWTN and all its outlets, obviously Catholic media has covered the Pope, whoever he is, with great interest. But beyond the ranks of Catholic media, it's been curiously uneventful compared to the last big pontificate.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned style over substance, because I think that's true. But also, I think the style tells us something. I'm a Chicagoan like the Pope. And so I know the place where he had his vestments made when he was a bishop and a cardinal. And for his new set of vestments that he told my friend Jerry Ahrens he wants to be kept at Castel Gandolfo, he chose House of Hanson on Irving Park Road in Chicago, Illinois, rather than going to Gamarelli. I thought that was very interesting. And again, it's also very Midwestern. Like, why would I go somewhere new? I already got a guy. Like, you know, I just go to the guy who has all my measurements. There's something very, you know, charming about it, but also it's not staged. You can tell it's very natural.
Yes, that's true. I think that's right. He comes across as very natural. And I think that's very reassuring. I can tell you anecdotally that if you talk to people who work in the Vatican, everybody's very happy. Everyone, there was under Pope Francis, a lot of people, of course, admired Pope Francis and supported the changes he was making. But there was a sense of precariousness and unpredictability. And from one moment to the next, you never knew it was going to happen. And some people found that exhausting. This Pope, they feel that things are on a very even keel.
You know, when the night that he was elected, Mary and I were both there. We were in St. Peter's Square. I remember that night saying to a group around a table later that he just seemed like a pope. And like you quote somebody in one of your articles saying it's like he's been a pope for 100 years. He's so naturally filled the role from the moment he stepped out. He just seemed really at ease. What do you think contributes to his just naturalness in the role? Is it his time in Peru, his nature, all of the above?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, he certainly isn't someone who's followed the traditional, if there's a career track, you know, to try to become Pope or to rise in the hierarchy, he hasn't done that. I mean, he was in his religious order. He says he was surprised when Pope Francis made him a bishop, especially since they'd had some disagreements before about things and administrative things. Ideological or theological issues, but so he was surprised when he became a bishop. Then he was sent as a missionary. And then I'm sure a lot of people were surprised when Pope Francis brought him to Rome to run the office of bishops. So you'd think that would be mean that it would take him longer to adjust. He's someone who's he's said to be someone who knows him pretty well, said that he's a great administrator. And as far as I know, we haven't had a real administrator as Pope since Paul VI. For all their virtues, all the men who've come after him were either not interested in administration or kind of chaotic about it. And he's supposed to be very good. So maybe that's part of it. He knows how he feels at home running an organization. In terms of tradition, he's reversed a lot of these departures from tradition that Pope Francis, not going to Castel Gandolfo and so forth. And maybe he finds that a kind of source of stability. He says, "I'm just playing. I'm not playing a role in the sense of faking it, but I mean, I'm carrying out a role that is very laden with tradition." And he hews closely to that tradition, and that maybe that gives him some stability too.
It was Thomas Aquinas, I think, who said grace builds on nature. And I think nature, with Pope Francis, was a very emotionally expressive South American. And nature with Pope Leo is a very solid, temperamentally introverted Chicagoan. And so but it's interesting to see how that plays out into their papacy. Even in such a short time, a lot of people are making comparisons to a young St. John Paul II because of the sort of interest in sports and. He kind of has a masculinity in his faith, that comes across. But he's also very much at ease with people. He was in Rome last night speaking to tens of thousands of young people who are there for this digital influencers concert and conference and meetings. But just completely off the cuff, gave a beautiful talk in three different languages about being the light of the world. And I think him having the gift of English as a first language, given it's really become the international language now, not French anymore. That's going to really help propel, I think, the church into this new century where communication is so important.
Yes, but there is a twist, and specifically about the remarks you just mentioned. If you notice, I'm sure you did. He said two very quick sentences in English at the beginning, and then otherwise he was in Italian and Spanish, which is funny because I mean he was speaking to an international group of young people. So probably if you had to pick a language, you would say English would be the safest bet. Or if you said, well, I'm going to stick to Italian because I'm the Bishop of Rome, then that would have a certain logic as well. But he actually spoke quite a lot of Spanish. I think he's, and I said this in the article, he has used English sparingly. And I think that has to do with, and I didn't get into this in detail, but I think he's certainly not denying his American identity at all. As you mentioned, he goes to his tailor in Chicago, and he's happy to receive presents of, t-shirts and deep dish pizza and so forth. But I think he's not leaning into it. Let's put it that way. He seems to be leaning into his identity as a when he came out on the loggia the first day. He spoke in Spanish, in Italian, and Spanish, and he greeted his former diocese in Peru. He didn't say anything about the United States, and I think he's we can infer why it might be he might not be rushing to overemphasize that. I think he's popular in America. People know that he's American born, and I think the rest of the world has mixed feelings about the United States. So probably as the leader of the Catholic Church, he's trying to strike a balance.
With regards to tradition, you're in the press, you know how this is. Everybody rushes to read tea leaves when they're not always there. But a lot of people, especially in Catholic media, were buzzing about the fact that when he came out, he was in the traditional papal garb that we were accustomed to, that Pope Francis opted not to use, and that he sings, he likes to sing in Latin. And so people are wondering if this means he's going to reverse the restrictions that Pope Francis put on the traditional Latin Mass. I know nobody knows, but what are your thoughts on that? And is there a way that he can maybe heal some of the rifts and the wounds that were caused by those restrictions?
Well, I don't know what his particular views on this are or were.
Sure.
I do know that, as you probably do as well, that even some very progressive supporters of Pope Francis and the hierarchy thought he really overdid it with the restrictions on the Latin Mass. As one bishop said to me, and certainly not a conservative, not a liturgical conservative or a theological conservative, and very pro Francis, but he said to me, he said, "Our problem is not people going to Mass." So I think, it's kind of there are some very militant people who really want to sort of just suppress it altogether. But I think the reigning assumption is that most people would probably take a slightly more moderate stance than Pope Francis did. So that's one factor. I think another factor is, yes, he has used Latin prayers. He mentioned, and this could be overinterpreting because we're all grasping desperately at whatever we can find. But he remember recently he was speaking to some, I think it was the day that a journalist published, the survey of the bishops that showed that most bishops had actually not said what Pope Francis suggested they had said, which was that he should, reverse Summorum Pontificum and the restrict the Mass. And so there was a kerfuffle about that. And that day, perhaps by coincidence, he was talking to some children and he said, "Oh, when I was little, the Mass was in Latin, and then one day it changed and it was in English, but it was the same Mass." And so, what does this mean? It's ambiguous, but it does seem to be saying, "Let's stop fighting." So again, that would be another clue that maybe he wants to calm things down a little bit. And one day, a way to do that, I think, would be perhaps to be less, a little bit less severe. I would say that I'm sure, and I don't know this. I mean, everyone I know who knows him says I'm sure he's not happy about that leak. The leak. And so popes don't like to be pushed around. They don't like to be lobbied, especially in public. So I'm sure if the traditional Latin Mass people were hoping that would push things in their direction, that was probably a mistake. If anything, it will slow it down, I think. But because I don't think he wants to look like he's responding to public pressure.
Right, or that he's taking a particular side. He's a very measured man, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that's clear. And he's being very careful. I mean, an early take that you saw in some outlets where people were saying, "Oh, well, he's giving a little bit here, a little bit there. He's going to be traditional in style, but he's going to stick with Pope Francis's agenda on synodality." I don't think that's clear by any means. He's being very careful. When he talks about synod, he says about synodality, he went to the council of the synod and he said, "Well, Pope Francis taught us that synodality is a style and an attitude." Well, what does that mean? I mean, that could mean it's okay, that's a frame of mind. I was recently watching a Q&A he did in Illinois last year. I think you may have seen it, at a St. Luke's church. He answered some questions and he talked about synodality. And again, what he said was very bland and very vague. It's like, well, we want lay people to take a bigger hand in the church in the spirit of Vatican II. So, there are obviously some people in the synod who taking part in the synod who wanted something much more, even radical, and other people who are frightened by that. So maybe he just simply wants to take a much more moderate approach where people get the chance to speak up and, but it's not clear. I'm saying is so far he has, as I said in the article, an old acquaintance of his said he places cards very close to his chest. And so far he seems to be doing that as Pope.
You actually had the opportunity to interview him. Tell us about that interview. This was more than 10 years ago, and now that is very much, back in the modern eye because you had a long, in-depth interview. What were some of the things that stood out from that interview then? And 10 years later now he's the Pope. What do you think about his remarks to you?
Well, it was actually 13 years ago, and I say that because the date was very significant. It was almost at the very end of Benedict's pontificate. It was the day after the last synod under Benedict, which is the synod on the new evangelization, which itself is a kind of concept that we then sort of receded from view a little bit under Pope Francis. It was very much associated with Benedict and I guess with John Paul. But he was head of the Augustinian order, and he came to my attention. At that time, I was running the Rome office of Catholic News Service, which, as you know, is run by the U.S. bishops. And I saw that he'd given an intervention at the synod on the new evangelization. It was very strong, countercultural message about how Western mass media was promoting what he called anti-Christian lifestyle choices. Like abortion, euthanasia, but also same-sex marriage and adoption by same-sex couples. And at the time, even at the time when this sort of countercultural message was stronger from the Vatican, it was a provocative speech. So I contacted him and said, "Can we come over and interview you?" And we also he recited his speech again on tape. We recorded him, and so we made a video out of that, which then in retro and now it's resurfaced. Let's say it was always up there on YouTube, so it wasn't hidden away. But and it created a little bit of a controversy at the beginning of his pontificate because some people are wondering, well, does he still think that way, or did he change his views under Francis at all? But I also took the I interviewed him, and we talked about a number of things. If I could go back in a time machine, I would have asked him about other things too, like for example the traditional Latin Mass. But at the time, there was no reason to ask him that. But he did talk about. We did talk about social media and evangelization, which was still obviously, a nascent phase compared to now. He talked about he was on Facebook, and he talked about some of the opportunities and some of the perils of that. And he talked about Saint Augustine, of course. So it was interesting. He was very articulate. He wasn't prepared. He didn't know what I was going to ask him. My questions were kind of rambling, and we went all over the place. And he was quite game. And you really get the impression if you watch the video, as I think you have, that he's listening very carefully and responding very thoughtfully. He's not being rhetorical. He's really giving sincere, penetrating answers.
One of the things that's very interesting about him is that he says has a very specific kind of trajectory to the priesthood, and it's one that he shared with another Chicagoan, the late Cardinal George. In fact, one of the last pictures I have of Cardinal George is at a party for Bishop Prevost when he was made a bishop, and it was right before he died, but before Cardinal George died. But they both went right from a Catholic grade school into a high school seminary run by a religious order. And they did that for different reasons. But it's interesting because that path is pretty much closed now. But we don't have any more high school seminaries for boys. Have you heard him speak of vocations, particularly to the priesthood or to the religious life? And how do you think he might encourage that during this pontificate?
I don't remember him talking about vocations specifically. I do remember I asked him, and I don't know why this was on my mind. It's have to go back 13 years, but about the religious orders and the new movements. In other words, to what extent were lay movements going to take that? And he made a point that did stick with me. He said, religious life is not as so much about what you're doing, but how you live and the service of your actual life. I'm not saying it as eloquently as he did, but in other words, it wasn't a functional thing. It's not like, oh, religious orders run schools or hospitals or charitable endeavors or something. It's about the consecrated life of the people. So, whereas I guess I think I would want to go back and listen to it again to be sure. But I think what he's saying was that maybe some of the movements are the ecclesial movements are, they perform certain functions, missionary function or, whatever. And so there is something very special about religious life. So I do remember that. He would say that, of course. He was the head of a religious order. But in terms of vocations, I don't remember him specifically addressing that.
So you've been covering the church for decades and upon decades, and one of the things I've noticed about Pope Leo is that he's very popular on social media. And for example, his off the cuff remarks to the Jubilee crowd, people were retweeting it with quotes like "vibes off the chart." And there's been a lot of discussion about how, especially in America, there's a Catholic moment. The Free Press wrote a piece, how Catholicism became cool. And this last Easter, there was just story upon story about, packed pews with catechumens coming into the church. And what do you think is behind this? Kind of one of my favorite questions for our guests. What do you think is behind this Catholic moment? And how do you see in America, and how do you see the first American pope playing into that?
Well, I don't have my finger on the pulse of what's happening in the States because I don't live there right now. But I know that there's some. My understanding is that some sociologists have are perhaps a more cautious view about trends and growth. But in any case, I do think that the fact that the head of the Catholic Church is an American now for the first time does in an important way mean that Catholicism is an American religion in a way that maybe some people didn't think it was before. I mean, if you
Really
see what I
interesting.
mean, I think that could logically give Catholics a sense. If, I mean, I think we're, a long way away from time when Catholics felt marginalized or estranged, but I think that, there are people who still think of Catholicism as not really Christian, and I think some Catholics feel that way, and there's unease, and maybe now this will give a confidence, a greater confidence to many people. So I suppose that could have an impact. Certainly, when he comes, as he will sooner or later, that will be a huge, huge moment. I presume he'll go to Chicago, maybe back to Philadelphia, apart from the obvious, sort of Washington, New York, and that will be a huge showcase, I think, for the church in the United States.
Yeah, well, the Chicago White Sox have already invited him to throw out the first pitch, any game of his choosing. So we'll see if that happens. But I can also see him going to the Southwest because he has been kind of outspoken on the migration issue. What's your insight into some of the things he's either tweeted or said during the audiences about that issue?
Well, I mean, I sort of never expected. It's a question in style. His style is obviously different. Remember, Pope Francis in February, sort of right toward the end of his life, sent a letter to the U.S. bishops, an open letter to the U.S. bishops, really criticizing, severely criticizing the Trump administration's deportation policy, and even kind of rebutting an argument that J.D. Vance had made about whether what do we owe to our neighbors as ahead of foreigners and that sort of thing. So it was a very he was really, really mixing it up there in a way that popes don't usually do in the internal politics of other countries. So this pope hasn't done anything, Leo hasn't done anything like that. He's been much more, again, measured. But I don't see any reason to believe that he doesn't fundamentally take the same view as Francis. And I think it would have been hard to imagine any of those cardinals who was electable, who would have taken a markedly different view on this matter, frankly. So, but again, I think it's not irrelevant. It's relevant that his brother is a very outspoken supporter of the Trump administration. I'm sure that I would be amazed if that reflects Leo's own views. But the point is that someone very close to him has those politics means that I think we're in for he's going to engage. He's certainly equipped to engage in an entirely different way from Pope Francis, who said that a person who builds a wall is not Christian, and basically it was a much more contentious, kind of censorious, some would say finger wagging. Whereas I can't believe that Leo will approach it that way. I think he would probably make the same demands on people, but I think he would understand because what people are aware of are anxious about, that it's not just that they're not Christian.
Right. Or they don't like immigrants or any of those kind of things. But speaking of his brothers, they've been a charming sort of adjacent story to his election. He's obviously from a very close-knit family, and came home every summer to Chicago to, go for pizza with his brothers and that sort of thing. That was the one sort of sadness I saw his brother express to a television reporter saying, we don't even know when we're going to be able to see him the next time. So his life completely changed, the Holy Father's, of course, but then also his family and even his Augustinian family.
Well, right. One of the brothers, I think, said they speak there or did speak every night. I'm not sure both of them did, but one of the brothers, of course, came over for the inaugural mass and ended up somehow in the. I'm not aware of the backstory on this, but in the papal library there with the U.S. entourage, with the Secretary of State and the Vice
Yeah,
President.
it looks like they might have flown on Air Force Two, the one brother from Florida.
That he got a lift. Yeah. Well, then
That's
of
what it
course, I
seems
think
to be.
he was in the White House in the Oval Office.
With a
So.
Hawaiian shirt on.
With the Hawaiian shirt on, which was great. No, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, Benedict used to see his brother, Georg, pretty often. He would come and stay for periods of time. Of course, his brother was a priest, not a married man. But so I don't know. I mean, Francis, of course, I think never saw his sister again, who's still, I think she's still alive.
She is, yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I suppose, yeah, he probably won't be going out for pizza in Chicago anymore, but. But I
Somebody
mean,
brought it to him at an audience yesterday, a
that's right,
pizza from
yeah.
Aurelio's. Oh, I don't know that travels well, but anyway. Well, Frank, we could talk to you all day long, but unfortunately, our time has come to an end. Listeners, to read all of Frank Rocca's insightful reporting about Pope Leo and all things Vatican, make sure to visit ncregister.com. That's the National Catholic Register. And to catch all of the great content by our TCA team, please visit thecatholicassociation.org. Thank you for joining us today.
We'd like to take a moment to thank all of our loyal listeners who tune in each week to Conversations with Consequences. As you all know, the Catholic Association is everywhere. We were on TV to cover the conclave and the election of the new pope. We're in print, we're online, and we're on social media. We've just launched a new Substack to expand our media presence and offer more great content from a Catholic perspective. We're on X, and now we're on Substack for Catholic Conversations with TCA, where we're featuring exciting new interviews, commentaries, videos, and more, featuring our four fellows, Ashley McGuire, Mary Fiorito, Lee Sneed, and Betsy Fentress. And we'll be having guest columnists each week as well. Just recently, Ashley shared some little-known facts about soon-to-be Saint Carlo Acutis. Lee Sneed writes about her forthcoming book on infertility, titled Infertile But Fruitful, and explains why she decided to write the book. So many people had responded to her columns and podcasts on her journey toward becoming an adoptive mother that she felt called to write a full-length book about it. In Lessons from the Turnaway Study, Mary Fiorito writes about mothers who wanted to abort their children initially, but were turned away for various reasons and had a very different take on their initial decision as years passed. And Betsy Fentress writes on hospitality and the will to live about a friend's father and a family friend with no relatives who were brought back to life by food, attention, and love. We hope you'll subscribe to our Substack. It's free. You'll find it at catholicassociation.substack.com. And we'd love for you to join us in our continuing Catholic conversations. Welcome to Conversations with Consequences, where I am once again joined with our esteemed TCA chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry, from Rome. Monsignor, what's going on in Rome today?
There's a lot. Rome is very young these days, Betsy. So I am here to speak on Monday at a panel for the Digital Jubilee, Digital Missionaries Jubilee and Catholic Influencers. But it's contemporaneous with the Jubilee for Youth. And so Rome's already been invaded by about 500,000 young people. It's supposed to grow to maybe up to 1 million this weekend for something that's the Jubilee equivalent of World Youth Day. And so the city is very young with all the languages. Pope Leo, these last couple of days, has been super excited to speak to the Jubilees. First of the Catholic digital missionaries from all across the globe who try to spread the faith through social media, for example. But the young people last night in St. Peter's Square for a mass with Archbishop Fisichella, at the end of which Pope Leo appeared to them and they were exuberant. And then again today at the General Wednesday audience with a crowd we haven't seen since his papal election. It's an exciting time to be in Rome.
That sounds wonderful. Well, I also saw a piece that you wrote in the National Catholic Register called Reach for Hope, Seven Steps for the Jubilee of Hope. And you talk a lot about young people, and I'd love for you to tell us more about that article and what you bring to the young in your seven steps.
Well, I think it's very important for us to, no matter how young we are, grow in hope during this Jubilee. There are great graces for all of us during this year. But I started it based on the Jubilee of Youth and how our young people naturally are hopeful. They're always looking for the future, looking for what's going to happen in their life, etc. But in the United States, a survey came out by the Centers for Disease Control 2 years ago that examined U.S. high school young people. And there were some really alarming signs, for example, with our girl, that 57% self-disclosed that they were persistently sad or hopeless. And I started to get into the reason for that. And one of the reasons is because the younger generations, either they're becoming, so the macro trend is that many are distancing themselves from God. They're being raised in a culture and in homes without God at the center. And so when they hit the inevitable difficulties that come in any human life, they don't have God to lean on. And that can lead to despair very quickly. The micro trend, of course, that I saw among the Catholics at Columbia is if they are practicing the faith, then they're practicing it with a much greater average intensity than their peers in previous generations. And so with that as a background, how do we help the young grow in hope? And I said the first of seven practices is we've got to teach them how to live with God in the middle of the world, which is a good practical definition of hope, how to be able to center their life on their relationship with God and therefore trust in him and rely on his help. The first is prayer, so that they're able to hear God saying, "Be not afraid, I am with you always."
Right.
Another very important practice after that is to begin to ponder Jesus's own life, that when we begin to examine what it would have been like on Good Friday and Holy Saturday and then Easter Sunday came, we begin to see what Christian hope really is, that he has risen from the dead. And if he's done that and we're on his side, then we're the disciples of the victor over sin and death. There's always hope when we start to do that. I look at some of the other practices. I don't want to go through all seven because then why would people want to read the Gathered Register?
Yeah, this is just the teaser.
That's where we begin, that this is a year for us to grow in hope. And each of us has to say, 7 months into the Jubilee now, have I been growing in hope? And am I a missionary of hope among others? Do I live in such a way that I am a source of hope? People can rely on me. And then I am a messenger of hope, helping them in the midst of their struggles and sorrows to be able to cast their anchor beyond the clouds, to use the image of the letter to Hebrews as it describes hope, and anchor themselves in eternal life with the God who has done everything to show how much he loves us and then wants to make it possible for us to live with him forever.
And what will your talk focus on, Monsignor? Can you give us a few tidbits of that?
My talk focused on the digital missionary as an influencer of God. So the theme of the conference was, how do we learn from the young holy ones throughout the centuries, how to be able to move others for God? Archbishop Fisichella talked about, or sorry, it was Cardinal Tagle talked about it to be what it means to be an influencer. Influencer comes from waters running and flowing in. And he says, we've got the living water of Jesus that's supposed to flow into us. Does it flow out of us? Are we sort of capturing people in this stream of life? And so the ones who teach us how to do that are the great holy ones. Soon to be Saint Carlo Acutis is one whom many young people have learned from, how to give witness to the World Wide Web to the reality of Jesus' presence in the Eucharist. But other holy ones that we focused on was soon to be Saint Pier Giorgio Frassati and the way he interacted with his friends, the servant of God, Chiara Corbella Petrillo, this young new St. Gianna Beretta Mola figure who died of cancer in order to be able to give birth to her child so that her child wouldn't be harmed in any way. And likewise, we looked at Sister Claire Crockett, a sister who died in an earthquake in Ecuador 9 years ago, and the type of joy and hope that she brought to other people. And so the true influencers is the theme of the conference. Are the saints, or the holy ones of God. They're the ones who have a lasting impact way beyond the typical shelf life of a tweet on X or a photo on Instagram. And so that's what I spoke about, and I've gotten good feedback from the talk on Monday.
Well, thank you for joining us and keeping us up to date on all things going on in Rome, and we look forward to talking to you next week.
God bless you, Betsy.
Thank you. I'm your host, Betsy Fentress, and we're delighted to have a producer with us of a new movie coming to theaters in September called Light of the World. This animated movie brings the story of Jesus to life until his resurrection through the eyes of one of his apostles, St. John. And it's so refreshing to have some wholesome content these days. Brendan, thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
How did you become interested in spearheading this project?
It was something that was actually thrust on me by the founder of our ministry. So we are a nonprofit ministry, and the founder said, well, I think God wants me to make a film on the life of Jesus, and it might be animated. So we had to just figure it out. So it was more of a responsibility that was given to us, and then we just had to run with it and figure out how to make it happen. It was in the goals of the ministry. Our mission is to craft stories to share Jesus Christ with the world. We do develop creative products in a variety of different mediums, and film is one of those.
Because when I was reading about you, it looks like you had a stint as a writer on a series called The Fall of Man, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so this is quite a segue from going from biblical fiction writing to producing a movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty different. You may think that there's a lot that they share in common. Very little they share in common. In producing a movie, what a producer does is basically has responsibility over the entirety of the production. So you get the key team members on board, you negotiate all the contracts, you handle the budget, you oversee the creative development, you push it to be better when it's weak in points. You have ultimate responsibility for it existing, it being made on budget and on time, and it not being awful. And so
that's a lot.
You kind of touch every area, although you don't really do the actual work. You hire other creatives to do it, but you oversee the whole process. And that's from start, funding to the very end when you're launching and marketing and doing all the distribution.
And you had no background in any of this. You just took a deep dive.
That's right. Yeah, it was trial by fire.
That is crazy. It's a beautiful film. I've only been able to watch the trailer online, but I immediately thought that it had the quality of a Pixar or Disney movie, and it looks like you've got a pretty stellar team. You want to tell us about some of the people on the team?
Yeah, we were very, very grateful to get people like Tony Bancroft, who is the director of Disney's original Mulan, to be our animation director. And the film is directed by John Schaefer and Tom Bancroft. And John Schaefer was the lead producer of CBN's revamped Superbook series. So he has a lot of experience doing biblical adaptations for children in animation. And he brought all that to this project as well. And then he's an employee of our nonprofit. And then Tom Bancroft was a kind of, old Disney legend animator. He animated things like shots from Beauty and the Beast to Simba from The Lion King to all the newer Disney animated films. Even did the design for Mushu from Mulan and was a supervising animator for that. So, yeah, lots of great people working on it. And then we also had our animation studio was in Kilkenny, Ireland. And a lot of the people who worked on our film worked on other films like Klaus or Wolfwalkers, a lot of boutique kind of newer animated features that most people listening probably have never heard of, but they're actually wonderful films. So
we had Tim Record on in December, and he did an animated film called The Star,
yeah.
I believe. And we had a conversation about what it's like to be a Christian in Hollywood and in the entertainment world. What was it like for you to approach these big name stars who do secular work, media production stars, and their reaction to doing a religious film?
It was interesting. Some people didn't want to be involved because they do not subscribe to Christianity whatsoever and find it to be offensive. And that was great to know on the front end and to have their kind know, because, if it's not the right project, you don't want to work together for 3 years. But there were many, many people who worked on the project who are Christians, who've worked in the industry for a long time, and this is a dream project for them. And then there was another set of people who are not Christians, but because they saw that we were really passionate about it and they saw the beauty of the actual work, and they thought that it was something creatively very interesting and good for the resume, they hopped on board. And so because we were able to hit the level of quality we were shooting for, we attracted a lot more high-end talent that were not Christians to work on it. And, you know, the mission field begins with you doing the work. You know, you being a Christian in the creative industry, you're not just a Christian because you love Jesus. You're a Christian because you treat people in the way that God would want you to treat them. And so, you know, it was a great opportunity to work alongside people and to have people who weren't Christians on our team. We made this film for non-Christians. And so for them to watch the film and say, "Oh, now I get what Christianity is about. I never knew before." I mean, we had some people who said things like, "I always knew what Christians were against, but I never knew what they stood for until working on this project. And this has really changed things for me." And so, yeah, it's been an interesting process for sure.
So are you based in LA?
No, I'm in Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
This was an unusual production. We probably couldn't have done it even 6 years ago. It was nearly fully remote. So we were working with people all across Europe and all across the US and, you know, other parts of the world. And all the people came together and contributed and made the film happen. So,
That's amazing.
yeah, it is amazing. And infrastructure, digital infrastructure has progressed to the point where we were actually able to do that. But it's definitely a different pipeline than how a lot of animated films were made in the past.
So, how would the distribution for Light of the World work? Is it a traditional channel that a normal, not normal, but that a Hollywood produced movie would go through, or what's it like?
So we are doing a traditional wide theatrical release of the film in many countries. Now I think we're up to nearly 30 countries that we're doing a theatrical release in. And yet we are an independent nonprofit ministry. And so we're distributing the film in theaters in the US independently. We're distributing the film across Central and South America independently. We hired on people internally who can actually do that, who've done it for many, many years. And so we're able to do it that way, which is really, really wonderful for us as a nonprofit because that means more of the actual box office dollars will go towards the ministry itself, to funding the ongoing ministry work rather than going to investors or to pay off debt or anything. So we're entering into this with no debt and no investors because it was all based on donated funds, and the proceeds go right back into funding ministry.
Right. So tell us about this. It's called the Salvation Poem Project. Is that
Yes,
correct?
that's correct.
Can you tell us how it got started, who's involved, how you got involved?
Yeah, so the nonprofit was actually formed by my father, Matt McPherson, and his wife, my mother, Sherry McPherson, and they had written a song called The Salvation Poem, which some of your listeners might be familiar with, but it's a six-line song formatted as a sinner's prayer that carries the essence of the gospel to every listener. It's in about 100 languages. It's been heard by over 1 billion people around the world and put in a variety of different media. Now, they formed the nonprofit to be a receptacle for that song, to carry on the mission of teaching that song to everyone in the world so that everyone in the world has a simple gospel message and can hear and know and wouldn't be able to forget it even if they tried. It's like Mary Had a Little Lamb. You couldn't forget it if I paid you $1 million to forget it. And through the years, you know, I became involved in the nonprofit, and about 4 years ago, I came into the position of being the president, and we decided that we were going to grow the nonprofit and transition it into being an actual nonprofit media company, crafting other types of content that is all gospel-centered, all Jesus-centric, to share Jesus with the world in the same way that the Salvation Poem has done. So Salvation Poem is sort of like a symbol of the type of stuff that we will do into the future. But we do film development, game development, multimedia discipleship courses, publishing products, etc. And the vast majority of everything that we do, we give away for free to ministries so that they can have tools to spread the gospel and to disciple people around the world.
So I saw on the website for the movie that you do have, it's kind of a multimedia project in that you have a Meet the Characters page, you have mini games. Is that, what about books? Will there be a book series or any or activity books related to Light of the World?
Yeah, we've partnered with Tyndale to publish all of our print products. And so there's going to be three children's coloring and activity books. There's going to be a children's picture book that tells a little side story of this little boy named Josiah from the film. and his journey of following Jesus and what he comes to mean to him. And then we also have a 90-day family devotional that can help families dive deeper into scripture and into following Jesus. And my good friend Natalie Hahnemann, who's, I think she's got her master's in divinity from a Catholic university, wrote that. And so we're excited about that. And then also, there's going to be a 400-page Bible storybook published next year that traces all of the stories from Old to New Testament that touch on the theme of light and darkness and kind of set the stage for the story of Jesus. And so it's each of the products, you know, it brings its own unique value. It's not just regurgitating stuff from the film, it's telling side stories or other stories that weren't covered in the film. So we're really excited about it, and we think it's going to bring a lot of value to people.
You know, in your press release, Brennan, you said that this film is that you said this new film is a movie that families have been waiting for, something you can watch together knowing it will clearly portray the truth of Jesus.
Yes.
Do you feel that there's really a lack of this type of thing in the culture today, or do you feel like the Christian media world has responded to the call?
When I look at the volume of media that's created, I think there's a definite lack of media that coherently and artfully communicates the truths of God. I think we need a lot more of it. And I think we need to not just focus on evangelism, but to focus on all of the other elements of the truths of Scripture and the truths of God and who He is and His personhood and how He interacts with us and what our purpose is. And so I think there's at this stage a paucity of great Christian media as opposed to what there could be. And I think it's great that many people have made the strides that they have. You know, I love seeing what Dallas Jenkins is doing with The Chosen, or the studio in South Africa is doing with the David movie, the animated David film, or even the David series. You know, it's good to see people trying to do stuff that is well done. But I think we can see a lot more of it, and I think the world would change for the better if we had more media that told the truths of Scripture in ways that were not propagandist, but are unabashedly promoting the truths and goods of God.
I had an opportunity to listen to Phil Vischer talk about his life in creating VeggieTales and what it was like that his company got so big that he felt like, you know, he didn't have the artistic control that he wanted. Are you an artistic director in this, and is that something that you like doing? Did you help write the script? Tell us about the artistic process.
Well, I mean, yeah, I was very involved in every element of the creative, you know, cutting trailers and developing the story. And, you know, originally I was the only writer on board at the very beginning, and then that soon became way too much. And there were other writers that were better that we got on board. But I stayed involved, and, you know, every major turning point in the story I was involved with. Making those decisions. So from the beginning to the end, I mean, even the designs of the characters and the look of the world and everything, you know, I had a part to play, a small part, but a part to play. And so there's animation is extremely collaborative. You know, there's very, very, very many people working, throwing their ideas into the pool. And a lot of them are really brilliant, and you should, you know, you should listen to them. But someone has to make the final call. And so it was very much a group effort. But
And
yes, I was.
tell us about
There's
the.
still some sequences in there that I wrote, like you know, like the creation story. It's been adapted and cut down and then put in a different place. And you know, even the baptism of Jesus, for example, and certain lines that survived. But it's been reworked and reworked so many times that it's like you almost can't tell where your work starts and where another person's ends. So.
Right. So you must have grown up in a household that really nurtured the arts. Tell us a little bit about your childhood, and were you a writer from a young age, or did you like cartoons, or how did all the pieces of your childhood inform this project?
Well, my parents were always musicians, and music was the thing for me. I thought I was going to be a full-time musician my whole life, and I was a full-time musician for a while. And then I realized I hated touring and wanted to have a family. And so I gave up music and decided to do the responsible thing and go to business school. And eventually, writing became something that I was interested in. I wasn't a big reader when I was young, I wasn't a writer. It was just a craft that I pursued, and I worked hard at it to not be awful. And that, I mean, it's like any craft. You can learn how to be a welder. You can learn how to be an electrician. It's a craft, even though it's an art form, it is a craft. And so, yeah, I'd say my mom always encouraged me, and my dad, that there's nothing that they didn't restrict or look down on the arts because they're artists themselves. But I wouldn't say that it was like, yeah, it's very artsy family. My dad's a businessman, and my mom's a stay-at-home mom, and it was a fairly normal kind of family upbringing. But I always was very much wanting to create things, and but most of it was music when I was young.
Because a lot of times someone's either an artist or they're the business person, and you, it sounds like you kind of have your finger in both pies, which is, I do
Definitely.
think, a little unusual.
I'm an artist who loves spreadsheets and budgets and contract negotiation.
That is unusual, don't you think?
Yeah, it is unusual, but you find in general people who are really, really highly specialized tend to be better at every at what they're at what they're doing. I'm more of a generalist, so I'm not like super excellent at any one thing,
Right.
but I try to make up for that by working really hard. So.
So is this kind of a pilot project for animation for the Salvation Poem Project? And are you already thinking about, yes, we loved doing animation, we want to do more? Are you thinking in that direction at all?
We want to do a whole variety of things: live action films, documentaries, and animated games, discipleship courses. We're a ministry, and our goals are ministry oriented. So we're going to make the tools that we think deserve to be made that would help people know and love Jesus. But as artists, of course, we would love to do more animation. It's just extremely expensive and time consuming. It's, a 3 to 5 year process to make an animated film, $20 to $60 million. It's very, very challenging. And so I think we would want a little bit of a break after this one. But this for us is a 30 plus year project. That's why we went with hand-drawn animation, because it'll look just as beautiful in 15 years. But we're going to be translating it into hundreds of languages. So it's sort of like a, it's our Jesus film, kind of, and it's, again, like the goals with it are missional rather than monetary.
Do you feel that there's been a buzz from the community, both Christian and just the movie world around the movie prior to its release, that they are people are excited about it, that it's, a timeless story that everybody still wants to hear over and over again from a different angle?
Yeah, there has been a lot of positive buzz. There's very few well-done 2D animated films that get wide theatrical releases these days, and that's been one of the things that has gotten people very excited. Especially millennials my age, the 30-somethings. We grew up on those Disney classic animated features, and this feels like nostalgia to all of us. It's kind of a blast from the past. And yet it's the story of Jesus, and that's never been done before at this level. And so people are very excited about it. And a lot of non-Christians and self-proclaimed atheists and agnostics have been commenting on our posts and saying, I'm atheist, I'm agnostic, but I'm here for this. This looks awesome. And, that's meaningful because it says that the art is quality, and we care a lot about it being quality. We don't want to be embarrassed by what we put out. We don't want to put out second-rate work. We want to put out something that truly moves people. And is well done. It's our form of worship. And so we worked hard to make it high quality, and we think that it's going to have a greater impact because of it being high quality. But at the end of the day, that's what matters most to us. And so we were really anxious leading up into this, because you always wonder, is it actually going to have in it the impact that we think it's going to have? But even in the early screenings that we've been doing, we've already had like 5 kids come to faith in Christ as a result of watching the film, and it's been changing people spiritually, and that's the win for us. That's the real success.
That is really exciting, and we're excited for you and looking forward to the film coming out. Thank you for joining us on our show. And for those interested in learning more about Brendan McPherson and his project, please visit lightoftheworld.com. Thanks for coming on the show today, Brendan.
Thanks so much, Beth.